You're listening to the Surgeons of Horror podcast.
John Carpenter.
The Early Years. The Fog.
Welcome to the second season of the Surgeons of Horror podcast. Its purpose is to look into the horror films, dissecting them one screen legend at a time. Our second horror legend and focus for this current season is director, writer, producer, composer John Carpenter. And we will look back at his career and basically look at the impact that he had on the horror film genre. So in order to do this, I need a team of, I was going to say, crack horror aficionados.
I don't know what I'm talking about.
So there's myself, lead surgeon Paul Farrell, and I'm joined to my right by the big cheese Anthony Yee.
Hi.
Although it's got the image there of the new fog.
Bullshit.
And on my left is Ben Skinner.
Good morrow slash Arbor.
Whatever your day is, the time of day is when you're listening to this.
Mexico or Russia.
Cool. Okay, so we're going to look at, this is our fifth installment of the John Carpenter early years, and as Ant has introduced with the music and the theme of, we're going to talk about The Fog.
The Fog.
Now, have you watched this?
I've seen it. This one I've seen, but I've not refreshed myself.
Was it one of, so you'd seen it prior to rewatching it recently?
I think, again, because the remake came out, you got excited, you bounced off the walls.
I did.
Said, John Carpenter's a fog. When I calmed you down, you told me John Carpenter's movie The Fog is a classic, and I was like, okay, I waited for the DVD to come out of the remake, saw the remake, said, that was shit, Paul. I said, see the classic. And I did. And I said, that's shit too. No. But the remake was pretty awful.
Who was in the remake?
Smallville guy.
There was a girl from Lost. She first became famous in Lost.
Like Elf Girl from Lord of the Rings.
No, not Elf Girl. Blonde one. The blonde one who gets in.
Pregnant.
She's kind of a bitch.
Aussie.
She's an
Australian.
No. She's the one. She has a brother, and they have a really
odd.
Oh, her. Relationship. Oh, yeah. But she was not in Lost for long.
No, they killed her off because she wanted to be taken.
Yeah.
Because she plays an 18-year-old girl, and she's clearly not 18.
Yeah, that's right.
And then the fog came just before after that.
Yeah.
I'm glad we took his three guesses.
I don't know what her name is.
Yeah,
she didn't
really
do much.
So you were saying that. So you rewatched it for the first time after the remake?
Yeah, after the remake, I saw it for the first time. And then I ended up losing the DVD for the remake, but I have the original. And I saw it last year again. Just to remind myself.
And I've done a refresher. Yeah. So, and for you, Ben, where are you coming into this for the movie?
Yeah, this is the first time yesterday. And first time yesterday. I usually refuse to watch those remakes unless I hear good buzz.
Yeah,
so I saw
The
Hills Have Eyes one.
Yes.
I didn't mind that one. I actually think I might have mentioned
that. That's not
so bad.
Yeah, you did.
In the podcast.
Until yesterday. Did you not see the original too?
No, yesterday was the first one.
Oh, right. That's what I was wondering. You said, oh, it's awesome.
So I'm coming in very fresh.
Oh,
yeah, cool.
Yeah.
No, that's good. And obviously I'm a hardcore John Carpenter fan, so I watched this when I was 3 or something stupid.
Your parents are a lot to answer for.
No, I was a bit older than that, I think. It came out, 1982? Anyway, after
that. No, wasn't that the thing?
82 is the thing. So it would have been. Oh, 1980 then. It would have been.
Oh, there you go.
A couple of years before. So, as is the case when we kind of look at these things, we kind of go through the plot and narrative of the film and we kind of goof around, talk all over it as we go through it. And I can see that Ant's riveted at this prospect. So we open, actually, interestingly though, on an Edgar Allan Poe quote saying, "Is all we seem or seem but a dream within a dream?"
Oh, okay.
Apparently that was there on Deborah Hill, producer's request. Wanted to have that. She was heavily influenced by Edgar Allan Poe, and this is used within it. So, but that automatically got me posing questions when I was rewatching it, going, so what are we meant to believe, that we're watching a dream within a dream? And in a sense, like, we open up with somebody telling a story, and then we then fall into that. We get the story kind of opening up doors to other avenues, but I don't know. Maybe I'm reading too much into it.
I never got that vibe at all.
Yeah.
No, well, that's what I'm wondering.
That
I think
feels like a Nightmare on Elm Street.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Inception.
Anyway. Yeah. Anyway, so we have a similar kind of opening to Halloween here. The remove the jack o' lantern and stick a fob watch in there, set on a black background. Before we then kind of pan out to reveal some kind of kids. in the background, and there's this kind of captain, seafaring kind of bloke who's... what was his name?
2.0. Sorry, you're about to describe what happens in this scene here, but yeah. It was such a great way to open the film, I thought.
With the retelling the story around a campfire,
it's like,
thing.
You know...
Oh, that's right.
It's like
that's why it's very Jaws, yeah, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's like the Indianapolis speech from Jaws, but the dude is creepy as fuck. And, like, if it just goes to show, like, the difference between films made back then and now. If it was made now, I mean, it was made recently, but you would have shown that as a whole prologue.
Yeah.
Everything he's describing, rather than just hearing
that's right.
Imagination.
That's right.
Scaring the shit out of the kids in the process.
Yeah. So, which is what he does. This guy kind of retelling the story about, an incident that occurred years ago where a fire was lit like a campfire and the ship was drawn and smashed to smithereens on the rock face. And it's kind of like meant to be given across this kind of, you know, old school kind of campfire horror story. We see it countless times. I'm not sure if this was the first instance of it in a horror sense of the words, but definitely we have it here. So, but then we kind of get the opening credits. It says The Fog. We get a guy, we see this guy who's fixing up a few fittings in the church, which is actually John Carpenter himself, playing a guy called Bennett.
Oh, okay.
And he goes, turns off the lights, and then tells a father in this church, who's Father Malone, played by Hal Holbrook. And he's telling himself to... so the father is helping himself to a drink, so we can kind of see that he's a little bit unbalanced, shall we say? Not
tipsy.
And that he's going to be... so Bennett's going to be heading out for the day. When the father calls after him, Bennett is already gone, but all of a sudden this brick comes loose and falls onto the table, and it reveals inside the brickwork behind the wall an old journal by another Father Malone, who's his grandfather.
And this is the first jump scare of the film as well.
Yeah, which is very much like a loud, big kind of music kind of sound behind it too. Did it make you jump? Did it?
Probably in a cinema it would have.
Yeah.
But not when you're
just trying to watch it on a set of headphones.
Yeah, things tend to lose their effect.
We have him Father Malone kind of looking at the diary entry, and there's a particular note there saying midnight to one belongs to the dead.
Yes, I do remember that.
Which is key for the events that occur. Yeah. Yes. We then hear a voice on the radio from a character called Stevie Wayne, who's played by Adrian Barbeau.
Yay!
We learn that the town... A big fan, obviously.
You are.
Well, you know I am. We spoke about it in Swamp Thing. We learned that the town is celebrating 100 years since it was founded. We're in the town, it's the dead of night, and all the phones begin to ring. A guy in a supermarket helps himself to some juice while he's cleaning up, and then we hear the sound of a window smashing, and the room shakes for a moment. What, helping yourself to... Yeah, I think so.
But if I remembered, like, every single shot in this film, which I remembered none of it, the one shot I did remember was the petrol pump falling out and landing.
So prior to rewatching it, you mean the last...
No, that's the one thing I took away from the first time I saw it.
After
the fact. That's a cool shot. It falls on the ground and the way it's lit and the way it's angled.
Yeah. Yeah.
So then, nothing more to add after this from Ed.
It's gonna be from Ben's side of the microphone from here on in.
So I'll do my best.
I'm just gonna catch Pokemon's here. Sorry.
In the middle of our podcast.
There's one on Ben's lunchbox.
You'll have to walk around a bit.
Yeah, if I drop the lure right now, you get people going thump. Yeah. Against the door in the glass. Anyway, go on.
We see that, you know, in the background we hear a window smashing, the room starts shaking for a moment, and when it's revealed that it's a little after 12 o'clock at night, so going back to the midnight to 1 a.m. thing. We get that shot that you were talking about, where we see these lights going back on at the petrol station before a gas pump pulls itself off the mount.
Sounds just as bad.
As it's leaking fuel.
Sprays everywhere.
Ed's doing that exact thing right now.
Yeah, if you could just put that away. Put your pump away. And then we get this car in the background that's being lifted by a hydraulics machine, while outside a load of car lights go on and the horns are blaring. With that shot that you were talking about too, that's all done, and I'm not technically minded, but it's done where you can see both foreground and background in the same shot. The idea being that you can see the pump and then car lifting up as well at the same time.
Does that mean it's been stitched together?
No, it was a particular lens that they were...
Is it a strain dimension?
Because there's a couple of ways you can do it.
Carpenter mentions it in this film and says, you know, it was the first time he probably kind of handled that, and he's quite proud of the way the shot kind of came out. I'm
pretty sure it's an Aussie invention, that.
Well, you have to look it up.
Which he painted, nobody knew how he did it for years.
Ooh.
Anyway.
So we then get to see a character called Sandy, who gets up to investigate the noise, and her TV comes on. And then a chair moves by itself. So kind of very kind of poltergeist type territory.
Pre-poltergeist.
And then we then cut to a car that's driving along the road. And inside the guy is a guy called Nick Castle. Character name's Nick Castle.
He's the guy who played the dad of the girl who killed herself in Lethal Weapon, right?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Tom Atkins.
I remember thinking he's not the lead. He's usually the... father of the girl gets killed, but this guy is youngish.
He's the lead in this.
Yeah.
Adrian Barbeau is technically the lead.
It's a bit of an ensemble, isn't it?
It is an ensemble cast. Yeah.
It's Nick.
He plays the lead in Halloween 3, Season of the Witch.
Oh, okay.
Among other things, but we'll get to down the point. So anyway, he's driving along, and we see him pick up a hitchhiker.
Don't do that, kids.
Unless
it's Jamie Lee Curtis.
And it's Jamie Lee Curtis.
Oh, well, apparently, that's a huge coincidence.
Yeah, he's playing a character called Elizabeth in this.
She's now 20 now.
Yes.
Yeah, she's quite a bit older. More older, like, playing older.
Yes.
Was a teenage girl.
Supposedly more mature.
Yeah.
Would you say?
Yeah. I got the impression she's a bit 20s at this point.
Yeah. And she says to him, "Are you weird?"
Yeah, that was an interesting line.
Which was weird.
Yeah. I liked it, though.
Very few people know that if you've been confronted by a murderer, if before they murder you, say, "Are you weird?" they can't kill you.
Oh, is that right?
That's the thing.
Yeah. Is that like calling shotgun to get the front of the car? So when you get in the car, you go, "Are you weird?"
Oh, shit.
Sorry, you can't kill me. Can't kill me now.
If he had said no, that would have set off alarm bells. But because he says yes... She's like, yeah.
That was a trick question, yes.
Yeah, that's it. And he knew it. He knew how to get out of it.
Ask grass or cash.
What she was actually asking in code was, "Will you sleep with me?"
Yeah. Which we found out later on. We're like, what? Anyway, we'll get to that. So suddenly the car windows smash and he pulls over and the car lights dim and flicker before they then just decide to drive on.
Are you weird? My car is.
Don't you think they could have thought about that a bit longer?
Quite quickly.
The windows just blew in. That's all right. Let's go back to my house.
You're talking at a time in a country when if you say, "Are you weird?" people can't murder you.
That's true. We then reveal Stevie for the first time at the radio station. She calls a guy from the weather station. Who's played by Charles Cyphers again, who was Sergeant Hackett.
Yep.
Now, interestingly, his character in this is Dan O'Bannon.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they're not really kind of original with their cast with the cast names in this one. It's like you, Ant.
Yeah, no.
I'm going to call you Paul in this.
Paul Skinner.
They'll never know.
We'll cycle back to it. And then I'm like, I kind of like Paul Skinner.
Dan O'Bannon is telling her that there is a fog bank approaching the bay. She announces a fog warning to the boat that's out at sea. And we cut to said boat with three guys goofing off when the fog bank mysteriously appears. The fog bank comes with a glowing light. What do we think of that as an effect?
It's a green light.
Not really. It's kind of a whitish.
I can't remember that.
It's like a whitish light.
I'm confusing it with the remake. Because in the remake, the boat was a bunch of drunk teenagers. Horny drunk teenagers on the boat. And then the same thing happens.
Yeah.
The fog comes in.
Comes in and goes, "All right, that's again. Quentin Beers."
Yeah.
Just with these guys, were they actually fishing or they just go out to sea and get shit-faced?
I think they're supposed to be fishing, but they go out and get shit-faced.
Right, okay, so they're just getting away from the wives.
Yeah.
It's the perk of the job, you see. What can go wrong when you're in the middle of the ocean?
Oh, we didn't get a very good catch tonight.
What can go wrong? Paul, tell them what can go wrong.
So, I can tell you. The fog envelops the boat and a pirate ship appears. There is a splash and shadowy figures appear on the boat. And then a sword is thrust through one of the guys, and then another guy is impaled with a hook.
There's a lot of guys.
That's what can go wrong if you get drunk on a in the boat in the middle of the night.
That's
they
it.
Don't do that.
The guy, the last guy who's below deck at this point, and then one of the mysterious figures comes below and grabs him. This is M-rated. Can I say that? So one of the mysterious
was the one who laughed.
One of the mysterious figures is below deck. Oh, no, it doesn't matter how you say it. And he basically stabs the other guy.
The third guy.
The third guy repeatedly in the face.
Ouch! Stab you in the face.
Which I do want to add is during the making of this movie, they made this movie, and when they finished it, they said it was shit. And they had, because it was, yeah, or even John Carpenter sat down and went, yeah, it's a bit shit. Yeah. So they reshot some stuff with added scares. And a lot of that was because Scanners was released, which suddenly changed the ball game as far as horror is concerned. Yeah. And they were like, oh, we need to add more kind of gore. So that particular scene, the stab, 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 was one of the ones that got reinserted in it.
I love
it. your turn to crack.
I'm getting a picture now.
So then we come then we go back to Stevie, who sees a mysterious light on the ocean before it then disappears again. We cut to another scene and Nick and Elizabeth are shacked up in bed.
Yep.
And he's gaff.
Yep.
Are you weird?
What?
Yeah. She's an independent girl.
Oh yeah, it's very long.
But don't you think that cut from A to Z really quickly? Like
it did a little. But I mean, like having said that, that's the sort of thing you see in a modern day British drama, and you don't mind it for some reason,
right?
Because the other.
But there didn't seem to be any sexual
at all.
No,
I don't know. There was a bit of touching when she got in the vehicle. there was a hint. There was a hint there.
Was there? I didn't. I missed that.
And he was a few beers in, presumably.
See, it was shocking because
of driving. Drinking and driving.
He was, that's true. That's true.
Maybe it's because it's Jamie Lee Curtis and
it's presumed. Yeah.
She's Halloween Jamie Lee Curtis. She's supposed to be.
Yeah, maybe.
Maybe that's the reason why she did it.
I do think it was.
Maybe they didn't have sex.
Yeah, assuming an awful lot.
She's just comfortable like
that. Would you like to get naked in my bed just sit by my side?
Yeah. While we look at your drawings.
That actually
can I buy this one? No, fuck you.
No, just getting naked in bed together.
There was a knock at a door, at the door, front door. Behind the screen, we see a shadowy figure, and they have a hook. He goes to open the door, and just as he does so, the clock face smashes, and it's revealed that it's 1 a.m. And when he opens the door, the figure is gone.
The figure's gone. Fuck. Seriously?
So is it right on the stroke of 1 a.m.?
Right on the stroke.
1:01.
Because he's saying to his ghost buddy, he's like, I'm just going to kill those people up the street. And I said, dude, it's like 2 minutes to one.
I won't be long.
No, I'll be fine. Oh, fuck, he's taking forever to answer. Oh, shit. And the guy, there's a guy back to the ghost ship, like I told you.
And he looks down and there's a box of milk tray on the floor, which only British people will understand.
Big blanks on this side of the table for benzene.
Okay.
we find now it's morning and we have this boy running along the beach. He finds a coin on the rocks. The waves come in and as it goes back again, it's revealed to be driftwood instead, with the words Dane written on it.
D-A-N-E.
D-A-N-E. And then the music flicks on.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The boy runs to the house and it's revealed that it's Stevie Wayne's son.
Stevie Wayne Wonder.
Selma Blair played this character in, not the boy, the mum in the remake.
She should have played the boy.
She would have played the boy. She's kind of got
Selma Blair boy. Hellboy.
Yeah, yes. She was in Hellboy, yeah.
Yeah.
That one.
She's gone. What happened to her?
She's gone off the rails a little bit, I heard.
Oh, really? Okay.
I've heard. I could be slanderously.
You could be. Whatever. You could be getting a lawsuit.
I could be in a lawsuit.
We'll be writing you.
Yeah. Fuck you, Ed! Yeah. You know nothing! Selma Blair's my hero!
So the Ghostbusters now, the sort of shit
coming
for that.
So when the boy returns to the house, he wakes his mum up.
I Selma Blair, because in this scene in the remake, Selma Blair's in like a shirt and just an underwear, and it looks really good.
So that's where we lost you for a bit.
That's why my mind go there. Exactly. That's why.
Summer Blair.
So either way, this character in whatever version so far is just really hot.
In which version are we talking about?
Both versions.
Both versions. Yeah, so totally. But don't you think...
Ant's hotness approval.
Does Selma Blair do the voice, though? Does she pull that off? Because part of the appeal of this...
Yeah, the radio DJ, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It was like...
And she's been used a lot. And like even more recently in Tales of Halloween, which we kind of both watched, she's the narrator to that, too. It's a bit of a...
No, but someone does the radio DJ voice. Yeah. Adrian's got the whole, it's Pipes of Steel.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Then we get cut to back to Nick, who's now at a wharf, and he's the one that's trying to figure out, you know, hey, the boat's disappeared, it's not come back, where's my mates? So he's kind of leading the investigation of what happened to the fisherman. We then also meet Kathy, who's played by Janet Leigh. And she seems to be great. Thanks, guys.
So that Jamie got home.
It's like we both knew this. We're doing our best.
Stitch it together. She seems to be overseeing the proceedings ahead of the town's 100 year celebrations. But confusingly, she's not the mayor or anything. She's kind of like an estate agent.
Yeah. So
person.
Why does she have like an assistant?
I don't know. It's really odd.
It's a smaller community. She takes on extra work.
Maybe.
She is the Natalie Vincent of this place. That's an in joke between the three of us.
Hi Nat. I don't know where to go with that one. So I'll go back to the movie. So we go back to Stevie, and she's driving along, and she hears on the radio about the boat and that it's lost at sea. Cue going back to Nick and Elizabeth again, who are now on another boat in search of the seagrass, and that's when they discover the boat in question, the seagrass, and it's empty.
Or is it?
The Mary Celeste.
Yes.
Or is it? Or is it full of pigeons? And pigeon poo. It's not. Kathy and Sandy. So Sandy, the assistant to Kathy, turns up at the parish to talk with Father Malone. And Father Malone then shows them the journal that he has discovered. He reads from it. So we get kind of a bit of background here, where it's discovered that there were six founders of Antonio Bay, including Malone's grandfather, and they deliberately sank and plundered the Elizabeth Dane, a clipper ship owned by Blake, who was a wealthy man with leprosy who wanted to establish a colony near Antonio Bay. The six conspirators lit a fire on the beach near treacherous rocks, and the crew of the clipper, deceived by the false beacon, crashed into them. Everyone aboard the ship perished. The six conspirators were motivated by both greed and disgust at the notion of having a leper colony nearby. Antonio Bay and its church were then founded with the gold plundered from the ship. So this is all the kind of...
big dick move.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this is all the kind of the premise of why these events are now occurring. Yeah. Elizabeth seems to reckon things... we're going back to Elizabeth on the boat with Nick. She reckons that things are going wrong since she arrived on the scene. And I quite like this line. She says, "Things seem to happen to me. I'm bad luck." I think that's a knowing nod to her role as Laurie Strode.
So, it gets a giggle.
Yeah.
It gets a giggle.
So after telling the story, Elizabeth then has a corpse fall on her.
See, what
is the double fake out? It's the jump scare.
Yeah.
And then the real jump scare.
That's right. So what we have is like in the closet, the handle starts to shift. So we know something's about to happen. And then the shelf falls down, which is the scare. And then all of a sudden the corpse comes out and goes, "All right, let's go."
It's the switcheroo.
But yeah. Or a double whammy.
Change up.
Which did actually scare a lot of people in the cinema when it was released. So we then go back to Stevie, who turns up at the lighthouse, which is home of the KAB radio station.
KAB.
So at the same time, Father Malone kind of becomes a bit distant, and he starts going, "There's a curse on Antonio Bay. We're all cursed, all of us." Yeah. Back at the radio station, the driftwood starts to leak water, and it appears... that there's an inscription. The inscription has changed, which now says six must die. The water leaks onto some of the equipment, causing an electrical fire. And when Stevie puts it out, the words have gone back to normal again. So a bit of a weird kind of illusionary thing. And my query around this, though, right, is that this is happening outside of the 12-1 curfew.
Yes.
So
they're breaking barriers.
Yeah. What's that about?
Yeah, I can imagine a script meeting you'd want to put that up. It's like, there's got to be rules, and you're violating your own rules.
Yeah, I just found that stood out to me.
But
or am I being too...
Why are they coming back in general at this particular point in time? Is that revealed later? Because I completely forget.
Why are they coming back? To get revenge on
the six... getting revenge now as opposed to...
Because 100 years.
It's 100 years, okay. So maybe because it's 100 years.
And I wonder if it's partly to do with 100 years or whether that's just a coincidence and it's more the fact that the brickwork kind of came loose.
Yes. And that's released on Mojo.
Yeah, a bit like Evil Dead, kind of thing.
That's a coincidence, though.
You reckon that's a coincidence? So what are you feeling like?
I think it's more likely the fact they were, for some...
What? I take a photo and they just stop talking.
Yeah. Like, what happened? Why did they stop talking?
Stopping their computer right now. What? Are they?
That's audio.
They've been taken by the pirates.
We have. So they come back to seek revenge on the townsfolk because of the way it was built. And founded.
Yeah.
So I don't know why particularly now, but what we do know is that three people have died.
So another three
you've got to go. And all I'm saying is there's three people in this room right now. No, it's got nothing to do with that. Anne, you alright?
I'm fine.
Shit. So we then go at the morgue, so this is where they've kind of have brought the corpse of the one of the bodies fishermen that they found. We met with a Dr. Phoebes.
Phoebes.
Not to be confused with the abominable Dr. Phoebes, played by Vincent Price, of which the name is a nod to. Oh. Although it is played by Darren Justin, who we are familiar with from Assault on Precinct 13.
Ah,
yes. Q Ant.
What?
Got a smoke.
Ah, yeah.
It's that dude. Smoke.
Oh, it's that dude. Okay, yeah. Cool. I forget.
And he tells Nick, he's telling Nick that the body has all the hallmarks of being submerged under the sea for months. But that can't be true.
I'm a doctor.
I'm not a dentist. Anyway.
No, I'm not.
We're mixing IPs again.
Yeah.
Nick notices the drop in temperature at this point, and the body of Dick Baxter comes to life, picks up a scalpel, and approaches Elizabeth before just stumbling to the ground.
This being scary. Ish, weird. Yeah.
This was
a little bit pointless, though, I think.
It is pointless, but it's,
because he doesn't do anything.
No, exactly.
And but is this because we are outside of the 12 and 1 o'clock power factor? I don't know what you call it. The witching hour, or whatever you call it.
We did literally the witching hour.
The witching hour. Because it's so is it more of a case that the strength isn't there, or is it just purely so he can write three on the floor? And he was trying to start a new game of hopscotch.
Why wait till now? Like,
yeah, he could have done it earlier.
He's got it in for
he doesn't like it.
Yeah.
Then everyone does.
So yeah. I did find that a weird moment. And also, this was another moment that was added to after the film.
Oh, right. That's what, okay, that makes sense. Because he is violating the rules, as you're saying.
Yeah, yeah. So it just... but I did find that a bit odd that kind of occurred, other than to just scare people.
Yeah.
And as I said, he writes the number three on the floor, indicating that there's three more victims.
Three have been killed.
Three have been killed. Three to go. Well, there's six people that are going to die. Six must die. We've been prophesying. So say that three have died.
or three are to die.
Or.
It's a classic thing you do in cricket. When you bowl, you're bowling and you say, how many left umpire needs three? Is that three to come or three to go?
Yeah, it's great. So,
just confused the Mexico.
Yeah, we have. You're like, what's cricket?
And we're huge in Mexico, so.
Here we are. We are huge in Mexico.
We actually are.
What is that about? I mean, we love you, Mexicans.
No, I'm not saying don't turn away. We're not questioning it.
But it's interesting.
That's what the Selma Blair fans are in Mexico.
That's what it is.
Freaking awesome.
Yeah.
Totes agree.
Which we should probably do, if that's the case, we should do an alternate podcast on. On what? Selma Blair. I was going to say on Robert Rodriguez, personally, but, you know.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Go
on. Anyway, so Nick notices... sorry, he's done that. So this is where we also cut to a scene which is like in a pub scene where... so night's descended and Kathy learns the death of her husband. Nick calls up the radio station to ask about the fog. All of this bit... all this kind of chitter chatter, it's all kind of a bit of a dialogue scene. It's all done in one take. I don't know if you guys noticed that.
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
Everyone kind of leaves, and it leaves Nick and Elizabeth propping up the bar, and then we follow Nick to the phone,
mm-hmm.
and then where he makes a phone call, all done in kind of one take, which is kind of interesting. Kind of.
Actually, after seeing how long, I probably should have re-seen this film to see how he's directed.
<It's, laughs> so should have watched it.
I think you raised the point. Covering a lot of pages of dialogue at once. He does it a few times.
Yeah, yeah. As well, he does. That's right. So then, Nick calls up the radio station and he's asking Stevie about the fog. And at this point, we see the fog is starting to drift back into town. We then go back to Dan, who's the weather guy, who phones Stevie to warn her of the fog bank. The lights go out at the weather station and the fog appears behind him. There's a knock at the door and Stevie warns him not to answer, but he does so anyway.
He's a right dick in this scene.
He is. He does that whole kind of, hey, what is it he calls her? Hey, darling, there's people at the door again. He does a whole... I noticed, like, all due respect to Charles and the actor, but, like, I found that during this bit, he's doing a lot of dialogue straight to camera when he's talking to her on the phone. There's kind of a lot of that going on. I don't know if that's intentional or not.
Okay, fourth wall.
Yeah. So it's kind of like...
He's looking, like, just off the side of the lens.
Is that what it is?
Yeah, I think.
Because it felt to me like he was looking straight down the barrel.
He's trying to, like, talk to her, but visualise...
Right, okay. Okay. So he answers the door, and of course then a hand then comes around and he is stabbed in the throat and pulled away, leaving a shocked Stevie on the other end of the line. She starts calling out for the sheriff to call her over the radio, mm-hmm. And as he gets called away from the, because there's a not a procession, like an announcement, you know, town announcement happening at the time to welcome in the 100 years celebration.
Mm-hmm.
And the sheriff is called away from that. He picks up the phone, but just as then, the lines go down and all the power goes out.
Fucking bastards.
It's getting intense.
He is, man. Mm-hmm. And then Stevie sees the fog approaching the shoreline. She runs down to the generator to get the power started. She's worried about her son, Andy, who is being looked after by his sitter, Mrs. Kobritz. The fog begins to descend on the house. There's a knock at the door. Mrs. Kobritz tells Andy to go to his room. She answers the door, and as Andy goes into his room, Mrs. Kobritz is dragged away. She's number five.
He doesn't see it happen, does he?
Number five is not alive.
Yeah.
Dead.
Dead.
Down and out. But he doesn't see it happening. But then we do go back into his bedroom, at which point someone starts to break in. Just by a bit of luck, Nick arrives on the scene in his car because he hears the radio call from Andy.
He knows exactly where
he knows. He does. Yeah. He goes, I'm going to go that way.
Yep.
Breaks through the window, gets Andy out of there. At which point, Elizabeth then tries to drive off, but it seems like it's been stuck by an unseen force. But they do eventually tear away and escape. I do want to add that this scene, as John Carpenter admitted, is ripped off from X the Unknown, which is a horror film. Yes!
Did you pick that straight away without being told?
No. Oh,
okay.
It's been a while since I've watched that movie, which I think you'd like, because it's more sci-fi bent than horror. All
right, cool.
So what part was stolen? Just the car getting bogged?
The car not being able to move as things are approaching towards it, and then finally kind of getting out. And it's more the shot as well with the tyre spin and stuff. So there's a lot kind of literally shot by shot ripped.
Okay, yeah.
From it.
Yeah.
Says
on storyboarding.
So at this point, exactly. Just watch this.
Yeah, it is.
Do that.
That's how Michael Bay makes his entire
film. Well, like, he openly admits that he lifts a lot of stuff from Howard Hawks. Like, there's a lot of stuff, and he says, I took that from that. I took that from that. So he's not like a shy with friend.
I know, we're billionaires, so fuck you.
I think this is a good point, too. I watched the extras on the DVD that I had of this, and they do this. There's an extra that's where they get him to kind of do a bit of a, I think they call it a scene kind of discussion. So they like basically get him to, like a in an audio commentary, but watching him watch the movie and he's talking about
it.
But what they've given, like, and on the film itself, is they've done a pan and scan job on it.
Oh, yeah.
And he shot the whole thing in CinemaScope, so it's meant to be done in 16:9. And the first thing he picks up on is that. Yeah. And he kind of looks
at it. The fuck is this?
I know, he kind of does. He kind of goes, oh, all right. Okay.
I can't see.
So he goes, what you would see if this was in the. and he kind of looks at it and he goes, well, it's your choice. I mean, it's your product. I mean, you know, if that's how you want to deal it, and then kind of goes on again. I was like, bloody hell!
And then he just ends up talking about pan and scan, like
the whole time.
He keeps going on about it. Yeah. It's like, you know. Anyway.
Anyway, that's what I have to say about aspect ratio.
And there's a point also in, I don't know why they left this in, but there's a point in it where, like, he stops and goes, "How much further do you want me to go on about this?" And there's like a quick cut, and then he's carrying on again. And I'm like, oh, it's brilliant. Priceless. It's
almost like the band end, like, what the fuck? Anyway,
I loved it. Okay, so then we go back to Sandy, who's driving Kathy home at this point, and this is where the fog starts entering the town, and you know, going apeshit. We hear the via.
It's angry fog.
Gonna get in your face and do stuff. So we hear from Stevie that the only safe haven is the church.
Of course.
Of which we then get Sandy, Kathy, Nick, Elizabeth, and Andy arriving at the church. None of the other residents.
Everybody
make
else
it.
Is dead.
Because of budget reasons, they've only just got the main. Five.
When I say it's a small survives. Town, I'm not fucking.
I guess they're all watching.
But it's a big kind of. They are.
I can see, like, Ben is a young guy going, that's what old people do. You mash, yeah.
Mash. Just stick mash on.
And the old guy saying, yeah, actually, yeah, we were, but that's not the point, man.
Open viewing cannot be missed. There was no VCRs.
There was no, that's it. Fuck the fog, mash is on.
You can't time shift this anyway.
So they kind of all arrive. So we're getting like the main principal cast, the ensemble, arriving at the church, and the Father Malone character appears to have given up all hope. They go into this kind of back room area. The fog then starts to also cover the lighthouse at the same time where Stevie is. Nick then kind of learns about the journal, and he goes and grabs it. So we're kind of cutting between the two locations here at this moment in time. Go back to the lighthouse, and there's a knock at the door. We go back to the church, and there are shadowy figures as they're trying to break in. Likewise, the lighthouse. The occupants of the church remove this gold cross from behind the wall. Father Malone picks it up and carries it out into the church hall. At the same time, Stevie hides outside the light on the lighthouse balcony as she watches a shadow walk around. She then climbs onto the roof, trying to distance herself as much as possible. Father Malone offers this gold cross back to the head kind of ghost character Blake, along with his body as comeuppance. A shadowy figure then starts to climb the roof of the lighthouse, and another takes a swipe at Stevie, mm-hmm. which kind of sends her backwards onto the floor, which is where Ant would like her to be. Sorry. I've lost you.
That's too much even for Ant.
I think so. Just as all seems lost, Blake, the head of the shadowy figures, then lays his hands on the cross, and then Father Malone and the cross start to kind of have a glow effect happen to them, almost like they're being electrocuted. Nick pulls him aside, and the ghosts all disappear. Likewise, they also disappear at the lighthouse too. The fog begins to eep away, and the ocean is clear again. At which point we get this Stevie going back on the air again. She says, "Something came out of the fog and tries to destroy us. Look out for the fog. This is a nod again to the original Thing from Another World."
Oh, okay.
Look out at the skies.
Blah, yeah. Blah, blah, blah. It felt like that kind of line.
Massive nod to it. Okay, so lots of, again, we get like these lots of location shots, like the conclusion of Halloween, so kind of reminding us of what was told before. Mm-hmm. And then everyone leaves the church, leaving Father Malone. Father Malone, alone. God, that was a mouthful. And he kind of mutters to himself, "Why not me?" At which point we see the fog materialise again. The ghosts appear. Just as Father Malone looks around, Blake appears with a sword in hand and swipes it as we cut to black. Close credits.
Boom.
Boom. Yeah, the remake, they extended this bit. By
did they?
They captured the Jamie Lee Curtis. Maggie Grace wasn't played.
Maggie Grace. So you see what he did there, guys? Yeah. Seamless. Yeah. Seamless.
Makes her his bride. That was, and that's why I saw she's the bride of the Chapman Blake. That was the added storyline they added to it.
She's the bride?
Yeah, or she's something like that. He takes her as his bride, and that's the end of the movie.
Oh, okay.
So that's why I was expecting that to happen in the original. I'm like, oh, that didn't happen at all. But still, it's a lame.
Is
metal.
She brainwashed into the?
Yeah, she thinks she's right.
That's a bit weird.
Sigourney Weaver, Ghostbusters kind of.
Yeah, it's kind of a. So it's an extra added layer where some bride they took.
I don't know if that is effective.
let's talk about the remake now.
Well, I think you could say that about the whole film, couldn't you?
About this film?
No, about the remake.
Yeah. Well, okay. So what were your having watched it for the first time? Go to you. Ben, being the newbie to the storyline, what was your initial without going into too much detail, what was your initial knee-jerk reaction after first watching it?
I liked the music.
Yep.
I thought that it went a long way to making some of the scenes towards the end more effective when the fog's actually closing in for real, and it's like that pulsing.
Yeah,
it just keeps building and building until it reaches like a crescendo, and then it starts building again. There are a few cool shots in this.
Yeah,
but it's just the actual, I guess, the plot device of the fog itself.
Yeah,
it's a little bit, and the actual. I don't know, just kind of the reasons why things happen are a little bit clumsy, and I didn't fully know why the cross and the book were buried, like walled away.
To hide away the secrets of...
Yeah, but why not just...
Destroy the evidence, says Ben. Yeah. Mr. President.
Like,
Mr. Nixon.
Were they keeping it for...
A rainy day.
Yeah.
Wasn't the cross made of gold or something?
Yeah. That was basically what the gold they stole was melted down into the cross. Yeah.
That's what I say.
And then they buried it behind a wall.
Yeah.
Now we don't spend it. Profit.
Yeah. So, like, no, I mean, that raises a good question too. Like, there is the premise of the fog itself came about when John Carpenter and Deborah Hill took a trip to Stonehenge. And there was eerie fog in the distance that kind of looked like it was pulsating.
Yeah.
And John turned to Deborah and said, "What do you think's in that?"
I
hope you said it like that.
and of which that kind of idea kind of played around with it. And the whole concept of the movie is supposed to be a nod to like the stories of, you know, the ghost stories of old. So it's and I wonder, in doing that, they kind of have bound themselves a bit and restricted themselves. Ghost stories weren't what people were looking towards. Ghost stories weren't actually what people were wanting at the time. They were wanting more shock horror, hence the Scanners thing and how that kind of... Yeah. So it kind of went against the grain of what people were looking at or looking for. If you can cast your mind back to when you first watched it, not recently watched it, what was your reaction? Having also, you're coming at it from watching Remake then this.
Yeah, I didn't like both of them. I was like, it just didn't hit me between the eyes. The thing about the fog, like, great idea.
Yeah.
Because, it is something that's relentless, you don't know what's coming out of it, but it didn't quite...
Yeah, I liked it. It wasn't the fog itself that I didn't... It's just, I think having that whole angle of the pirates within the fog, just being, they're just another, like, cooked killer, like, within the fog.
Yeah.
It's like, either just have the fog or have the guys, have the pirates by themselves, but...
Yeah.
If the fog, it's as an elemental thing, could kill you, I think that's creepy enough in itself.
Yeah.
They kind of touched on that, weirdly enough, in the last Hunger Games, where one of the devices to kill the players is the fog. If she'll touch you, it just burns you.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And that's kind of like a running... How do you outrun a fog? You don't, you're fucked. So that was kind of cool. The other movie I think of is The Mist.
I know, I was about to say that.
Which was also a big disappointment for me.
What?
You didn't like The Mist?
I didn't like The Mist.
Because I think that used The Mist.
The Mist did it better, I thought. Yeah, in terms of the logic
of it.
And what comes out of it.
Yeah.
I think The Mist is an underrated movie, personally.
So do I. I think it's one of the... Yeah.
It's a definitely. Really, really smart movie. And worth rewatching. Ant.
And
I don't like Heath Ledger in it. Anyway.
Is he in it?
No.
I was like, where was he in it? Is that because, isn't he the Joker?
He's the Joker.
Ah, okay. Yeah. Gotcha.
thinks he's the Joker.
He's the Joker. Cool. All right. So, from my point of view, it's a weird one because I don't think it's up there with his best.
No.
But it does have this kind of feel or something that pulls you into it.
I think the script's good. I like the characters.
Yeah.
I think there's some good... There's no one that I really... Like, there's one or two annoying ones, which you tend to get. But,
it's got this good ensemble thing going on, which he does lean towards anyway. We kind of see that a lot more in his later work, I would have said. Than in the earlier stuff.
Yeah.
But this is an indication of where he's going with that, I feel. Well, and I think this is a good point to kind of talk about the players of the piece. We've got the lead, which is played by Adrienne Barbeau, Stevie Wayne. We were, as seen her already in in lots full glory in Swamp Thong. Swamp Thuggers.
The porn version. Can we do the porn version of every one of the films we talk about?
No. probably because they already exist. And to be fair,
they really exist. That's why can we talk about them? Would we have nothing to talk about, or would we have too much?
I don't know. That's a good point.
I can see you getting into that genre of.
I can see Anne being very, very homely.
I'm not saying making it. I want to do a podcast about seeing.
I get you.
I want you to make it. I want you to be the Yule Bowl of.
Yule Bowl of porn films. That's
love like
poop spoil.
Aim high.
That's it.
Yule Bowl porn.
So what I was trying to say is that we've already seen her in Swamp Thing and Someone's Watching Me, which Ben and I discussed prior, and then this movie as well. So it kind of crowns the trio of the movies that we'll probably focus on her in particular.
Escape from New York.
Escape from New York. We'll also see her in Escape from New York. But what do we think of her performance in this? Like she's gone from Someone's Watching Me, which was a support role, and it's probably the first instance where she's meant to be a lead, albeit a lead of an ensemble cast.
I didn't notice the voice until you pointed it out, but she does have a good radio DJ voice.
Awesome voice.
Yeah.
So have her talk to me at night. I tell you.
Yeah, she did Love Song Dedication.
Mate, she's got a voice of an angel. In-joke.
A lot of in-jokes today.
There is. We do apologise, listeners.
Good.
You want to get higher pitched.
You went all Larry David.
You did.
Ben.
What was your thoughts?
I liked the radio voice also.
Yeah.
I think it kind of initially I was like, who the fuck would have a radio station in such a hard to read place? Like, but then it made sense. You know,
because
she's sitting. Well, it means that it's a good way for a character to have like a.
Overall view.
Yeah,
that's right. And they kind of, you know, the idea is that she's. At the highest point, even though she has to climb down 300 odd steps to get to it, but she's also like it's there because it's a fishing village too. So she's technically there as
to tell people about
stuff as well.
Weather
warnings. Remember she gets 8-track cassette tapes. That's
right. Promos.
Promos. And
she listens to them.
Yeah,
that's right. It's like the pretty sad.
That's kind of like an analog version of our life, which is why I was interested in that bit.
Being given shit and having to be forced to listen to it.
The things that people think just appear out of nowhere and someone's actually going to make them.
Hey, listen to this. Listen to what I got here.
Can I ask a question? Where was this filmed?
North of San Francisco, but it's quite close to where The Birds was filmed.
Ah, yeah.
Just a bit south of that. Huh?
Is it the same lighthouse that features in The Birds?
No.
Okay.
There is a wharf that features in The Birds, though.
Yeah. But the lighthouse is the same... At all the same location, or White House was a separate kind of because it's cool.
All the outside locations are all set around that area.
Yes,
obviously, there's a lot of internal scenes as well.
Like a small seaside town, kind of.
Yeah.
It's a nice
all shot around there, which is kind of cool. Yeah, it was good, pretty cool. Let's switch to the other female lead, Jamie Lee Curtis, in this. We've obviously talked about her in Halloween podcast. She does return again, as we mentioned, with John Carpenter, providing the voice of the narrator of the computer in the intro of Escape from New York. She's a markedly different character in this one. How do we rate her as her role in this?
Meh.
I don't think she gets enough. She probably doesn't just get enough scenes.
Yeah.
Really.
Okay.
Like before the shit starts going down. But she seems. She's definitely more confident.
She
is initially, and then she kind of just turns back into that damsel in distress kind of.
Yeah, it's weird, isn't it? Like her role kind of doesn't do anything really. Like it is wishy washy, meanders.
Well,
she only
does into something interesting, which is sleep with a guy in the second scene that she's in.
Yeah.
That makes you okay. So what's it about? And then everything else is just.
It's alluded to that she has a past that she carries with her, which is all kind of interesting. But then
Never
nothing
really
gets revealed or explored. So For me, it's a weaker character of the group.
She ends up just following him around for the rest of the movie.
Yeah.
Whereas, and that's what was great about those early scenes, is that she seemed like a strong,
independent woman.
Yeah.
Which is odd too, because both Deborah and John Carpenter are known for writing strong female roles. And maybe it's a case that the Stevie Wayne character is so strong that it kind of doesn't leave much room.
She was married to John Carpenter at the time.
Hold on. Yes, Adrian Barbeau was, yes.
So this has been 2 years since Halloween?
Yes.
So those 2 years he dumped Deborah Hill and married Barbeau?
Yeah.
Oh, isn't that
curious? Yes, it is. Thanks. It happens.
Yeah.
Yes, it does.
Man loves a woman. Sometimes falls out of
But they still work together. How weird is that?
Because I had a really good working relationship. I thought I struck on a good theory, and then it was quashed. And I'll explain it, right? Because I was like, John Carpenter did really well up to a certain point. And a lot of that was he was teamed with Deborah Hill.
Right.
And I was like, was it a point where that relationship broke down as far as working relationship that it all went sour for him? But then I looked on the credits and noticed that Deborah Hill also produced Escape from L.A. And I went, oh, okay, that theory is possible. Yeah.
Yes,
but maybe, I don't know, maybe it's just, you know, trying to... That's a different beast. Yeah. But I do wonder if that's where things started falling off the wheels a bit.
I think people, sometimes, there's just a particular point. A
nugget of chemistry.
Like when you're at your most productive.
Yeah, that's true.
You're on fire.
Filmmaking is like, you're like an athlete. You have your peak years, I feel.
Yeah.
But the most famous husband wife team I know of is Cameron and Galen Hurd.
Yes.
And when they went their separate ways, they still do good films, I guess, in their own way. But yeah.
Chris Nolan.
Wife, that's his producer.
And so is Jackson and Pippa Moyes, is that her?
Yep.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're right. There's a lot. I mean, it happens.
She's a screenwriter as well. She is. With him.
I know.
And then you kind of probably need not that. A good example. Zack Snyder and his wife.
What does she do?
She produces as well.
Oh,
sure.
Oh, okay. Apparently, Suicide Squad's quite a surprise, supposedly.
It's supposed to be good.
Yeah.
Yeah, I heard that too. Have you seen the Max Center with the wall?
No.
It's impressive. But I mean, I think their marketing's been good for that, but they also needed to do well.
Suppose you're going to shake it up a bit. Let's take a quick look at the other players of the piece then. So we've got Janet Leigh, as we mentioned.
Jamie's mum playing
the role of Kathy Williams, obviously primarily known for her role as Marion Crane in Psycho. She was also in Touch of Evil, the Manchurian Candidate, and would crop up again in Halloween H2O 20 years later.
Jamie's mum.
Again, like, she's not got much to do in this apart from be, I guess, the town figurehead, kind of moving things around a bit. Do you think it's a wasted opportunity for her with someone of her talent?
It's just, yeah, anyone could have played that role, I think. It's a nice fan service, but it's not.
I agree. I just found that. There was one kind of good kind of, I guess, scare moment. Like, you could tell that she could switch on the scare moment when they were being attacked in the church. And you could see that a faint sign that there's talent there to be played with. But, yeah, it just didn't feel like it was explored to her potential.
What did she say about her participation in the film?
But she was just a big supporter of it, like really kind of pushed it. And even like there was a shot, I think, outside or something, and of the pub or something, and the pub landlord was getting a bit shirty because it was going over time, but he was a big fan of her, and she basically just went, oh, I'll go have a chat with him, and just basically kind of pulled him away and just talked to him for hours while they tried to kind of keep going. So she had which I guess is a sign of how dedicated she is to the film she kind of takes part in, which is, you know, massive hats off.
Respect.
So we also had Tom Atkins, who played Nick Castle. It's a good name. We kind of mentioned him, you know, before, but he did play Lieutenant Tom Sullivan in Serpico TV series. He would reunite again with Carpenter for Escape from New York as a character called Rain. He would play Stan, the role of Stan, in the prologue and an epilogue of Creepshow. As I said, he at the beginning of this, he also was in Halloween 3, Season of the Witch, as you mentioned, Lethal Weapon.
Mm-hmm.
And he was also in the 2009 version of My Bloody Valentine.
Who's in that one?
Do we care? From Supernatural?
Yeah, I think you're right.
One of those brothers that I can never differentiate.
Ethan and Amy Hutton's on Facebook.
I'm familiar with
Amy and her passion.
If you're listening, I don't know you are. I know you are. How many seasons in now are we, Amy?
It's 10 or 11 now.
Isn't it the last one?
Is this... I don't know, because last one was supposed to be the last one, they extended for another one.
Okay.
All I know is that, Amy, if I ever love another human being the way you love this show, I will be a very happy man. And I love Sarah.
I sincerely
Holy shit, woman.
Don't do it, covering your ass.
Yeah.
Girlfriend.
All done, all done. Okay, so then we also...
Nobody loves another human being the way you love this show.
We also have Hal Holbrook, who played the Father Malone character. Massive, massive name on this, to be honest, considering he's not really a big role within it. He plays Lieutenant Briggs in Magnum Force. He played Deep Throat in All the President's Men. Played Dr. James Calloway in Capricorn 1. He was in Creepshow as well. Played Lou Manheim in Wall Street. Was in Fletch Lives. Played Oliver Lambert in The Firm. Was the Assistant Secretary of State Albie Duncan in The West Wing. And more recently played Nate Maddock in Sons of Anarchy. So he's a big kind of name player to have on this, and he actually said he didn't like this film.
What did he do? Money?
Oh, I guess so. I mean, it was after the fact.
Why did he like the film?
I don't know. All I know is that it was commented that he wasn't... probably. That he wasn't a fan of it. Just wasn't. That's what I heard. Wasn't a fan of the movie.
He got killed.
So, but what do we think of his performance in this? He's essentially there to play the melancholic role. You have to have one of those kind of doom and gloom kind of foreseers in this. Is it paint by numbers? Do we see that there could be?
A little bit. He doesn't really modulate his performance at all. It's kind of just one note throughout.
That's right, yeah.
He's got that. Was he meant to be an alcoholic?
Yes, he was meant to be an alcoholic, okay. Yeah.
Because I'm just going to get this cross. he has a death wish. Like, he always wants to die.
He does. Yeah, he is. He's the one that's more... Like, interestingly, like, seeing he's supposed to be the closest to God in this, he's the most willing to give himself up. Like, but, like, again, a big note to the fact that he did carry that cross and it did look like it was heavy as shit.
Okay,
that's why he didn't enjoy the reason. You can't have a prop cross. No, it's going
to
be gold.
They wanted to take it home, they wouldn't let him take it. He wanted to keep that prop.
That's it. Exactly.
It's going to be real.
So again, the last couple of people I just want to make a nod to is Charles Cyphers, again returning, a bit of a returner for Carpenter's go-to actors. He's the guy that played Dan O'Bannon. In this, we've seen him in Assault on Precinct 13, as we said, Sheriff Brackett in Halloween, and we will also see him return as Secretary of State in Escape from New York. We don't need to talk about his performance in this. We kind of already covered it in the fact that he did all the, to me, looked like he was doing the dialogue to camera stuff. it seemed really cheesy, his performance in this.
Yeah, it wasn't particularly.
No,
I think he was actually meant to be a little bit of comic relief.
Yes. But, yeah. I do want to... the last person I want to kind of just mention off-screen and doing the special makeup was a guy called Rob Bowton, who provided makeup for 1976 King Kong. He was the makeup assistant on Star Wars A New Hope, special makeup for Piranha, The Howling, The Thing, The Witches of Eastwick, Legend, RoboCop, 7... Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, Fight Club, Game of Thrones episode The Lion and the Rose, which was in season 4 episode 2.
Just one episode.
I've not heard of any of those.
No. So what do we think? No. So I just wanted to do a big nod to him because he was actually...
That's huge.
There's a bit in it which there's a particular character that's in it who, if you're going to make a franchise out of this thing... and want somebody to come back, there's a kind of character that they describe as Wormface, who's on top of the lighthouse, and there's a moment where he kind of turns, and you see all these kind of worms crawling out of his face.
That's the only time you really see a close-up of
that's it, yeah. Yes, yeah. And to me, kind of is almost like a chance there for a potential kind of... If they were ever... this isn't ever going to get remade into anything, so...
Wormface.
But I kind of feel like... Because, like, the Blake guy, you could have him coming back, but you know, if you're gonna have like a bit of a monster thing, this is probably an avenue where you could explore that. And it's a pretty gruesome kind of shot that you see, even though it's up for what, 2 seconds worth. But it was enough to scare the audiences at the time, who were kind of horrified by what they were seeing.
Was that an insert shot?
Huh?
Was that an insert shot?
No, I don't think that was. I think that one was actually kind
insert,
of
good. Yeah. It's cool. I like the flashing red eyes as well.
Yeah. There are kind of some. Yeah, there's some cool effects with that, and also like. I mean, the thing is though, it harks to the unknown factor and stuff, so which I always say adds to the more scary kind of prospect. And I think that could have been explored a lot more if they could have had more kind of moments coming out of the fog. You know, he's already done it with Lights and Shadow within Halloween, with Mike Myers coming out of the shadows and stuff. Yeah. I think if they could have done that a lot more, using fog.
Imagine there's more of silhouettes playing with that.
I do. I think that could have been stuff. I mean, but having said that, they were experimenting a lot, and fog's always a hard thing to kind of film.
Fog's very tough. I'm sure it would have been tough. I need to watch. Is the doco any good on the DVD?
One of them is, like there's one, the audio commentary I didn't think offered that much, but there's another one where they have a lot of the players all talking.
Was there a lot of shots where they just reversed the flow?
That's exactly what they did. Yeah. And they basically said to the actors too, don't blink, which I would have been useless at, as Ant would know, because when you reverse a shot, blinking just looks fucking odd.
Yeah.
So basically kind of
told looks them. how Tom Hanks looked in that Christmas movie that Zemeckis made.
That's because they reversed all of that. Polar Express, you're talking about.
The Polar Express was where everybody found out about the uncanny valley.
Yeah, it does.
Those kids were freaky as fuck.
Talk about a horror movie. So let's take a quick look at the director's note. As I said, or kind of mentioned, that it was a fairly successful movie. It had to be remade because there was a lack of scares in it, and this was partly due to the success of Scanners. It cost about $1.1 million to make. Now, considering that's cheap, but considering Halloween was made for $300,000, this is a big step up for Carpenter at this point. It was a two movie deal with Avco Embassy to kind of couple along with Escape from New York. It was geared around an old fashioned ghost story, but as I said, people were looking more to overt horror films at the time. As I mentioned, Carpenter is a big fan of Howard Hawks, and the Stevie Wayne character is a massive nod to the femme fatale characters within that, particularly of Lauren Bacall and the roles that she brought to it, and hence why she smokes in it too, which is a nod to the Lauren Bacall kind of stuff, because somebody did say, why did she smoke, and he goes, it's because of that. One of the locations, as I said, was shared with Alfred Hitchcock's The Birds. The mood they were going for was a big nod to H.P. Lovecraft kind of novels and stuff. Interestingly, in the commentary as well, which I think is kind of true of the film itself, that John Carpenter has noted when he's talking about it in back, he says, the movie seems so innocent now, it's funny how times change. And I think that's true. I think, like, even though they changed a lot of things in it, the scare factor still isn't kind of, you know, that it does. It's not really packed with a punch.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They needed to either go with full out blunt force in your face kind of scare or go the sinister route.
Yeah.
And I don't think they kind of did either.
Yeah.
Some of the fog scenes, as I said, were shot backwards, as we mentioned. A lot of it was shot on a black velvet. With the fog going across
she wore black
velvet. And then they kind of superimpose that over the other shots, so that's kind of why you get this kind of effect.
Oh, okay.
The movie.
I just love the hand motions. Yeah. when we entertain shadow puppets.
He's about to reveal a dove.
I'm the fog. I'm the fog. I'm coming for you.
This is Paul's acting school coming through here.
You know it.
Paul, be the fog.
Ooh.
There, that sounds.
Paul, don't blink.
Okay.
Okay, he keeps fouling that one.
The last thing I want to add is the movie poster was really misleading. I don't know if you've seen the cover.
It's
basically green. Jamie Lee Curtis holding back the door with the fog trying to creep through.
Yeah.
Which was used because they were trying to ride off the coattails of Halloween and they were trying to get the Jamie Lee.
Sure.
Which defies it because she's not the lead in it, and it kind of was.
I can understand. Big. If you're a marketing guy, like, you're gonna go for the safe bet, and the safe bet is to use that star power that you got.
That's it.
And they don't give a fuck about it.
Don't give a fuck.
Filmmaking things.
Which kind of rounds up our little nuggets around the film and stuff. So I guess the last thing is just lasting impressions on the movie.
Not his best work.
That's
not even great. It's not even good.
It is good. No. It's good. It's not. It's better than most.
That's good. Not good for me.
It's better than the
could have been better, because I thought it was going to be really cool. Cool premise.
Yeah. Cool. It's a massively cool premise, yeah. And I think a lot more could have been done with it for sure.
That's why I'm disappointed.
Yeah. But like I think I said this too. But there is something that pulls me in with it though, that intrigues me with it. I do agree. I don't think it's anywhere near his best material.
I mean,
but yeah. There is something about it that is watching.
We woke up. We all live in Sydney, obviously. Waking up yesterday, there's an insane amount of fog that rolled.
There
in.
Was.
You couldn't awesome. Only just see the Harbour Bridge. I wish I'd seen the movie before that happened. and I would have photoshopped something together. it probably would have been a better poster than the,
that's
than
the thing.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Why is Harbour Bridge in this movie? I love it.
What?
Look at the little boat. there's a bridge above us.
Your character is a sounds like a muppet for some reason.
Yeah. Kermit. Well, Kermit in the fog. And the
missing IPs again.
The so just to round out your thoughts on that, Ben. Sorry, you were saying how
the fog itself.
Yeah, yeah.
Was cool, but not necessarily like placing those characters within the fog.
Yeah.
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 I mean, if it's kind of like if they, I understand why they remade it. They saw potential in that and they remade it. But it would have been cool if someone that really understood horror and appreciated what he did made that instead.
Yeah, I agree. I part of me wants to go. It would be really good to see this remade. But then we saw the remake of it.
It's
remake.
Been done.
Remake the remake.
But then again, it's not really stopping. Like I can't believe
what,
it.
What you do is turn into a TV series.
Yeah.
An HBO series.
Yeah.
Does it have...
Well, then what you do is the HBO thing of, like, just 10 characters who are fucking each other and there's lots of storyline. And then you get the fog, like, really interesting kill.
Boobs in fog.
Very interesting kill in the first episode. Nothing happens to episodes 2 through to 6, and then 7, 8, 9 ramps up.
Oh, you just got it all worked out, don't you?
That sounds dumb, man.
Yeah.
I'm starting... Stranger Things is starting to feel that way to me a little bit.
Yeah, are you watching that?
No. I'm going to watch it. I don't have Netflix. I know that's criminal, but I've got it at my in-laws' place, and we're over there this week. So I'm going to be going. Right.
It's a mixture of Dante, Spielberg, and Carpenter, and all three of them deserve royalties for like
a lot of
amount of nostalgia.
Oh, as soon as the freaking
but now
theme music comes on, I'm like, have they consulted John Carpenter about it?
But then
designed the font, whoever designed the font.
Yeah, that 80s font, yeah.
But then, like, aren't you. But that's the whole point, isn't it? Isn't it? It's a massive homage to.
Yeah,
it's good.
I was just worried that it would be too reliant on nostalgia, but it's own thing as well.
Yeah,
it's actually got its own story going on. Sure.
And on that note, that concludes this the fifth horror film surgery of the season. Stick around for our next and last session of the series on Escape from New York. We hope you enjoyed our discussions. Next time, we are Ben Skinner.
Adios.
Anthony Yee.
Hi.
And your humble host, Paul Fowle. Goodbye.
You're listening to the Surgeons of Horror podcast.
John Carpenter.
The early years. The fog. Music supplied by Peter Nezick. For more discussions or podcasts, head over to surgeonsofhorror.com or head over to our Facebook and Twitter sites for the latest news and updates.